ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
About 20 years ago, when I started out in academe, I won't name the university, but I was working as a casual. I did it for about 8 years, like a lot of us do.
This is Giuseppe Carabatta. These days, he's at UTS Business School.
And what happened was that they decided, oh, look, we need you to step up, Giuseppe, and we need you to subject coordinate this course. And that means under the EBA, and still does today, you get a higher rate as a casual. When I then turned around and said, okay, well, look, I've done it for you. I've done it for the last year. You should have paid me for it. HR said, maybe. I did formalise it. It's probably the only time I've done this. But I went to the union. We got the money back. And guess what happened? My contract wasn't renewed.
That's why people don't complain about their pay, especially when they're starting out. Hello, I'm Richard Aidy. This is The Money. Today, we're looking at wage theft. Not being paid what you should be paid for doing higher duties is just one form of it. Rebecca Thistleton's Executive Director of the McKell Institute, Victoria.
Unfortunately, for every way that you can be paid in Australia, there is a corresponding form of wage theft. So in terms of things like the time spent working, it might be things like not being paid from the time that you actually arrive at the workplace and actually start doing work. We find that that's a big problem in retail, where there's an expectation on workers to arrive, say, 15, 20 minutes before their shift starts, to do things like putting the float into the till, doing a bit of cleaning, making sure that all of the stock is out and everything else. And then after their shift ends at the end of the day, that's when they start to get ready for the next shift. In terms of things like not being paid entitlements, that might be something like not getting penalty rates on a long weekend, or things like not getting your long service leave paid, which is a huge problem that the Fair Work Commission has come across quite a lot. There's also a lot of problems too with people not receiving their superannuation, or if they are getting paid super, a lot of cases where it's actually being underpaid.
So how much is this costing?
Yeah, so we estimated last year that wage theft was costing workers at least $847 million. But that figure itself was based purely on the work that the Fair Work Commission had done in terms of actually going out and proactively auditing businesses or responding to complaints. So in terms of all of the other businesses where there hasn't been that level of investigation or interrogation, the reality would be well over $1 billion a year.
Actually, the Queensland Parliament's put it even higher than that, I think, just for their state alone.
They have, yes, especially when you consider the gross loss to a state in terms of the broader economic impacts that happen when that money isn't ending up in people's pockets, so they aren't spending it in their local economy. So for Queensland, they were expecting that it was costing their state $2.5 billion a year.
Do we know how widespread wage theft is?
The Fair Work data, it's quite telling. In terms of the amount of businesses that they've gone out and audited, since 2009, they've had about 170 different audit campaigns. And that's involved them going and looking over the books of more than 60,000 businesses. And in that work, they found that more than 40% of those businesses were non-compliant. And that's not just in terms of money not ending up in people's pockets. It's also other conditions for workers as well. But when you consider that it's more than 40% of 60,000 businesses, I think that's quite telling in terms of what a systemic problem this is across the country.
Who's doing this, Giuseppe? Which employers have been involved?
So within the last decade, you look at construction, but obviously fast food, cafes, restaurants, where it's pretty much rife. If you believe the SDA, the Shop Distributive and Allied Employees Union, which looks after retail and cafes and bars and warehouses, They estimated last year that they got 14,000 anonymous tip-offs. They reckon it's about 25% of that workforce they feel is underpaid. So that's just within that sector. Then you've got the big boys and girls, I like to call them. So Bunnings, Coles, Woolworths, Qantas, massive shopping list.
Today, Coles became the latest in a long line of well-known brands, including the ABC, to admit underpaying staff. The supermarket giant will set aside $20 million.
Target is today's addition to the list of companies confessing to shortchanging workers, to the tune of $9 million, just a day after Coles joined the queue. Is this deliberate exploitation of workers or a failure?
There are fresh revelations that young foreign workers are being deliberately underpaid in parts of the blueberry industry on the New South Wales north coast. An investigation by the Australian Workers Union.
Two of Australia's biggest universities have apologised for underpaying staff by millions of dollars amid ongoing investigations into wage theft and mass casualisation of tertiary education workers. The Vice-Chancellor has appeared before...
The National Australia Bank has been taken to court over allegations that thousands of staff have been bullied into working excessive unpaid hours at nights, weekends and even while on holiday. The Finance Sector Union claims the bank's culture amounts to wages theft and unbearable levels of stress and anxiety for staff who feared they'd be sacked if they refused the demands.
And just last month, we've got the CBA, not to mention BHP, McDonald's and KFC, but the CBA case is very interesting because it was huge. A massive fine was ordered by the federal court, $10.3 million, and the judge said, this is about deterrence and I want the message to get out, not only to the CBA, who are well-resourced, so the penalties should be a function of how many resources they have, which was interesting, but I really want the message to get across more broadly. So that's the CBA, and that's just last month. Then you've got the celebrity chefs. We don't need to name them, I'm sure.
Let's not. What's clear is that wage theft has grown over the last couple of decades. Stephen Clibborn, who's at the University of Sydney, says this is because of changes to industrial relations policy and law and changes to migration policy.
We used to have a system based on permanent migration for the purpose of nation building. And with that came rights and security. We also had high union membership and an industrial relations legal system that supported unions or the collective voice for workers to increase their power and allow them to negotiate fair terms and conditions at work and be in the workplace to enforce them. We've moved now to a system of migration based on the startling rise in temporary migration. That is for immigrants with restricted rights to be in the country and restricted work rights, and also restricted social support. So that has created a population of, in some cases, permanently temporary workers with restricted rights in a way that creates vulnerabilities for them to mistreatment at work, restricts their ability to do anything about it, for instance, to leave a bad workplace and move to another one.
What's the range, Stephen, in terms of compliance?
I've interviewed dozens of employers in excess of 60, and in industries where we're most likely to see underpayment, like hospitality, retail, horticulture. And there is a wide range from those who are dedicated to compliance with the various laws, including employment laws, and they apply the time and the resources to ensuring that they comply with those laws as part of operating a business. And they're often the businesses that seem to be the most successful because they're dedicated to success in a range of areas, their business and including compliance. We range all the way through from the fully compliant to the exploitative, to the deliberately underpaying employers. I found that the underpayment occurs on a continuum between those two.
For some, their business only makes money if they underpay, and they'll take steps to work out exactly how much they can get away with.
This business owner explained to me that it wasn't the legal minimum wage that decided what he would pay some of his workers. He benchmarked in the local retailers in that suburb what they were paying their workers, and then aimed to just pay a little bit above what was in essence the local market rate, rather than the Australian legal rate.
That localised approach can happen anywhere.
One thing that's really come across in a lot of the work and the research that we've done is what a problem wage theft is just across the board. It is just a part of our working culture. A lot of members of the public would not be surprised to hear that there are a lot of problems in things like hospitality and retail. But sometimes things like not being paid for the full amount of hours that you work or having a cultural expectation on you in the workplace to be doing more work than what you're actually being paid for, sometimes people don't pick up on the fact that that actually is wage theft straight away, and they don't put it in that same basket as being ripped off their penalty rates on the weekend. And it is something that does happen across the board, even in a lot of white-collar professional areas where people wouldn't expect this to be an issue. It's still quite a big problem.
Yeah, the ACTU has described it as culturally ingrained across industries.
That was something that, was really evident when we spoke to workers that had found that they weren't being paid their entitlements in inner Melbourne cafes that are really popular and really trendy, where people want to go and work. And there was a real arrogance from the business owners there whenever the workers tried to speak up for themselves. They were told, well, look, I've got 10 CVs on my desk. If you want to leave now, I'll just get someone in QuickSmart to replace you. And I think too that that's something that's also really come through in professional areas where you've got young people that are fresh out of uni and that are really trying to get themselves into an industry. And so they end up buying into this environment where if you want to set yourself apart from your colleagues, you're working longer hours, you're going well above and beyond what you're actually being paid to do.
When people realise that's what's happening and then muster the courage to have the conversation, and then if they're really determined, talk to a union or a lawyer and take legal action and end up winning, that takes years. And then you can't talk about it because employers insist on non-disclosure agreements or NDAs.
It's really common, and it's that's also one of our recommendations from our report last year, is for NDAs to be banned when it comes to an agreement being put in place between a worker and their employer. Because, you know, quite often too, an employer would much rather settle a disagreement with a worker over wage theft than have it get to the point where it ends up in the courts, because that's a really expensive way to do things. And there's also the reputational damage as well. So for a lot of employers, they would much prefer to come to a settlement agreement, pay out the worker, back pay them, but make sure that that worker has got a gag on them from being able to speak out about it, which also means that a lot of workers are left feeling like they've really done the wrong thing by their fellow colleagues as well by not being able to speak up either.
There's a clear consensus on who's most vulnerable to wage theft. Temporary migrants who face restrictions on their ability to work, those in precarious work, so casuals or independent contractors, and young people, especially children. Paula McDonald from Queensland University of Technology.
So the definition of employment is when there's an employment contract in place, and this is the type of work that children typically do, and we see them in cafes and stores and fast food outlets or entertainment venues or so on. It also includes young people who are engaged in apprenticeships or traineeships. A recent Victorian study showed that more than half of children are employed in these kinds of jobs, and, you know, we'd expect that, but also a sizable minority work in a range of other industries like administration and support services and arts and recreation and so on.
Okay.
So having said that, the kinds of work that children do is more diverse than just employment. So it can include informal service work, and we might think about a lot of the jobs that listeners probably started doing when they were 12 or 13, like babysitting or lawn mowing or labouring.
Mm.
But it can also include activities in family businesses, such as on farms or in restaurants or corner stores, that kind of thing. And work in family businesses is explicitly excluded from state-based child employment legislation. And then another, I guess, more recent phenomenon that could also be potentially included within the definition of work is child influences, or what has become colloquially known as kidfluences. And these are children with large social media followings who earn money by posting sponsored content, or if they're younger children, they might feature in a parent's social media content.
Are kids particularly vulnerable because they're less likely to complain?
Yes, less likely to complain and less likely to know. But I'll just preface my response to that by saying that there are some really good employers out there, including those who employ large numbers of young people. However, for some employers, it's a case of if you can exploit young workers and in the process lower your employment costs, then unfortunately you will. So a significant problem is that young workers, as you said, often don't complain about poor, dangerous or damaging working conditions. And that includes underpayments, and it also includes where there's injuries involved or sexual harassment and bullying. That is a problem across the spectrum. And some research I did a few years ago showed that if young workers complain about being underpaid or some other problem in their work, that that can be met by punitive responses. So that could be even like as severe as outright dismissal, mm-hmm. or it could be being offered fewer shifts or just getting a general sort of chilling out.
I believe the phrase is, we don't like your attitude.
Exactly.
This comes down to an asymmetry between employer and child.
The power difference between a 14 or 15-year-old and their employer can be very wide. And, you know, kids are just dipping their toes in the world of work. They often know something about their obligations, but they often don't know very much about their rights. They're also unlikely to be a member of a union. We know that youth union rates are extremely low in Australia. And interestingly, they don't always inform their parents about poor working experiences either.
Paula believes that wage theft from children is very much informed by the conditions of their legal employment.
The Fair Work Act, which governs most employees, explicitly leaves child employment legislation to the states and territories. But the one matter that it does address directly is junior rates of pay. So modern awards specifically set special rates of pay for juniors, and that includes not just children under 18, but young people under 21. And that's irrespective of their productivity or experience. These rates of pay are based explicitly on age rather than skill or capacity, and they're basically exempted from any other terms which would be considered to be discriminatory. So in fast food, for example, it's completely lawful to pay a 15-year-old or a child younger than that 40% of the adult wage, and a 16-year-old 50% of the adult wage, and a 17-year-old 60% of the adult wage. So these are really low rates of pay. And as I'm sure people can appreciate, there are massive savings to be made through employing younger workers on those rates, especially in retail and fast food. So the reality is that this youth wage system that Australia has, which I should say is actually unusual by world standards, it in effect deliberately discriminates on the basis of age. And in my view, it excludes children and young people from what we call wage justice, or the opportunity to get paid an equal amount of pay for an equal amount of work.
This is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. Today, we're looking at wage theft. Stephen Clibborn from the University of Sydney Business School has spoken to many employers who don't pay their employees fairly. Stephen, one of the things you hear when this is in the media from employers and their peak bodies, actually, is that it isn't deliberate, it's because the system's complicated.
That is a common explanation given, or I suppose rationalisation for underpayment of wages, that our industrial relations system, in particular the award system of minimum pay and conditions, is complex. And the suggestion is that there's a direct correlation between that complexity and businesses underpaying. My research has found that there's a relationship, but it's not a direct correlation. It provides a barrier to employers paying correctly because they need to gain information and they need to put effort and resources into compliance. So I found that many of them who are underpaying, it's because they're not dedicating enough of their resources to ensuring that they pay correctly.
Not paying people correctly becomes riskier next January when wage theft becomes a criminal offence. Giuseppe Carabetta.
Look, I think it's great, not in the sense that it's going to pick a lot of these cases up, because it's criminalising means that it needs to be intentional, and a lot of these cases are not intentional. They are, you know, due to the complexity, they are maybe negligent, but they're not intentional. So that's a high bar. Also, criminalisation doesn't do anything about getting money back for workers at all. It's all about punishing the employer, and that is it. But in terms of sending a message, I do agree with Tony Burke that it will definitely get the message out. And I can tell you anecdotally, Richard, that so I like to step out of my ivory tower and I talk to a lot of people, including restaurateurs, including a brother of mine who runs a very successful restaurant in Surry Hills. He was on the phone immediately. So it's getting people's attention.
So this is making it kind of front of mind for people who maybe haven't thought about it as much before.
Absolutely, no question.
Stephen, what do you think about this change?
Criminalising wage theft will make some difference, but it's definitely not a magic bullet that will cause currently non-compliant employers to comply. There are many different aspects to changing employers' behaviour, and I think that that is the key when assessing policies, to ask the question, will these policies make currently non-compliant employers comply voluntarily? What we do know from international research is that the key is not just to increase the penalty. The key is to increase enforcement. To put that bluntly, it's not just about the size of the stick, it's about the chance of being hit with it.
So what will make employers think that they'll get hit with a stick?
So it's about increasing the power, or flip side of that, reducing the vulnerabilities of the workers. And a big part of that is allowing them, or facilitating their rights to act collectively, facilitating the rights of unions, for instance, to enter workplaces. The other side is the resources. So increasing the resources of the Fair Work Ombudsman, increasing the resources of unions or their capabilities.
Essentially reversing 30-odd years of industrial policy.
That's true. Unions used to be a central part of both setting minimum wages and conditions of work and enforcing them in the workplace, because union density was up as high as 60-odd percent, and we're now down to below 10% in the private sector. So the union is not in the workplace as much. We have many more small businesses where it's difficult for unions to get into workplaces and organise. So yes, it has changed, and there are restrictions on the abilities of unions to enter workplaces as well.
That last one's been wound back slightly by the Albanese government's closing loopholes changes. And Rebecca Thistleton says there are other things that can be done too.
Making sure that there is a lot of work done to simplify the awards as well, so that employers do find it easier to do the right thing, but also that there isn't as much of a chance for people to fall back on saying, well, I didn't understand the rules, especially now that that won't be an option for them when it comes to the fact that there will be much tougher measures against people doing the wrong thing. The fact alone that employees will be held criminally responsible for wage theft, it does mean that we are confident that there will be more employees seeking to do the right thing. But from the outset, making the system easier to comply with will go a long way to making sure that employees know the right thing to do, but also that employees have an increased awareness about their rights under the system as well.
This is going to be controversial, and it's almost impossible for small employers, but I've argued that we should have some sort of formal obligation, at least for large employers, to regularly and independently audit. Some of them are doing it, and that's fantastic. But I think that, you know, regular independent payroll reviews to make sure that your applications are keeping up, that you're actually on top of the issue. Further to that, Richard, it's a communications issue. It's a systems issue. So you've got the line managers actually doing the figures or doing the payroll, in a sense, in a lot of organisations, particularly where you've got casuals that they're supervising. So there needs to be better communication between HR and those line managers. I can tell you on a positive note, if I've been a bit negative, that where I am at the moment, the university, what it's done all of a sudden is it's made all the supervisors undertake mandatory modules where, you know, you have to work out this is what the enterprise agreement says, and then they'll test you on. And if you keep doing that, I mean, it's not enough, but if you keep doing that and you keep having conversations, that will be a big help.
Speaking of big help, there are already changes to the immigration system that Stephen Clibborn believes will make a difference.
There have been changes, for instance, to increase the mobility of temporary migrant workers to allow them to more easily leave a bad situation, such as an exploitative or underpaying employer, and go to a better employer. Also a more effective way of skills being utilised where they're needed. And the example I'm thinking of there is the recently announced change from the TSS visa, the temporary skill shortage visa, used to be the 457 visa, to the recently announced skills in demand visa. Under the temporary skill shortage visa at present, temporary migrant workers' right to be in the country is tied to their sponsoring employer. If they lose their job with that employer, then they have only 60 days to find another sponsor of their visa. So under the newly announced changes, a worker in that situation will have 180 days to find another sponsoring employer, and they may work for anyone else during that 180 days. Right. So that great dependence that's created by that kind of sponsorship arrangement that ties a worker to their employer puts incredible pressure on a worker and restricts their ability to stand up for their rights. So that's one of a number of positive changes.
Paula McDonald, who researches the vulnerability of children at work, has a big idea.
We could scrap the discriminatory youth wage system. However, there have been some historical efforts to do that, and as you can imagine, they've been met with very significant backlash from industry, which clearly benefits from this ready supply of cheap and flexible labour. So more realistically, what we really need to see, in the absence of legislation at a federal level, we need firstly the development of and also some harmonisation of state child employment laws that cover work that's undertaken by minors. That includes not only employment but also some rules around work undertaken in family businesses, for example, or, you know, if children are working via an ABN. So the current state laws vary really dramatically in scope. South Australia and Tasmania has no specific child employment regulation whatsoever. So we need to develop some safeguards around that, and also ones that are resilient to challenge, because remember, you know, we've got industries which are significantly benefiting with the status quo. But of course, regulation, as always, is not a panacea, and it can't necessarily protect children from poor management practices at workplace level. So I think, as well as regulation, it's possible, for example, to develop a voluntary accreditation system or some national industry codes. And we certainly need better monitoring functions, such as they have in Victoria, around wage theft and other problematic working conditions. And so an example of that, I was very pleased to see that the Fair Work Ombudsman recently received an additional $32 million over 4 years to implement wage theft reforms.
Paula McDonald is Professor of Work and Organisation at QUT. You also heard from Associate Professor Stephen Clibborn from the University of Sydney, Associate Professor Giuseppe Carabetta of the UTS Business School, and the Executive Director of the McKell Institute Victoria, Rebecca Thistleton. The money comes to you from Gadigal Land, Sydney. It's produced by Whitney Fitzsimmons. Our sound engineer is Hamish Camilleri. I'm Richard Aidy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.